Matt is back. On today's Golazzo, we round up all the latest news. And for our slice of calcio culture, we go back to the 80s, mateys, for the most surprising Italian title winners ever, My Verona. Hey everyone, school's in session and it's back to summer 1984 as Against All Odds cements the global popularity of smooth cranium crooner Phil Collins. In Italy, one of the greatest tales of beating the odds that the Campionato's ever seen is about to get underway. The story of Hellas Verona, champions in the 84-85 season. Gabriele Marcotti is here with us, James Horncastle as well. Gabriele, is it fair to say that this is your favourite ever season of Italian football?
I think in many ways it was a season that everything came together. Back then you had a limit of two foreigners per team, as most people know. I think that season, pound for pound, the foreigners in Serie A were probably as good as have been assembled in a single league anywhere in the history of football.
We'll list them very, very shortly. And the fact that Verona, with 17 players, a squad of 17 players, were able to defeat all of them is something that's quite extraordinary. We'll also look at maybe some of the reasons why that happened that particular season later on. James Horncastle, your parents were barely born when this season took place. But yet, you know, anyone who spent time in and around Italian football, you can't move for bumping into the legend, the miracolo of Verona.
Yeah, I actually got to spend some time 5 or 6 years ago now with the mastermind of this, Osvaldo Bagnoli, who is a pensioner who lives a very simple life, not too far away from the Stadio Bentegodi. You know, who I think a lot of people who live in that neck of the woods obviously know, but would see him cycling or taking his daughter to work in his sort of old banged out Fiat.
He had successful spells at Genoa and then at Inter afterwards, but chose to return to Verona.
Yeah, and he left the game quite early, really. He was 58 when he got sacked by Inter and didn't really feel there was a place for him in the modern 90s game, which was, he, I think, was quite offended that he was made out to be a bit of a dinosaur, I think, at a time when Sacchi was obviously changing the game and he was made out to be an old-fashioned Italian manager, even though I remember him telling me he always had a libero who would step out from the back in Tricella, play the ball. He always had three attacking players in that team. But yeah, went home to his wife that day and she said, what's happening? He said, it's over forever.
All right, well, let's go back then to Bagnoli's greatest ever season, the season of Hellas Verona, the season of Shulis Prebenelkia, the season of 84-85. That's right, listener, it is summer 1984, and as Tarzan Boy by Milanese Italo disco outfit Baltimora conquered charts the world over. Back in Italy, the big talk was centred not in Verona, not at the Bentegodi, but way down south at the San Paolo in Naples, where Diego Maradona had become the latest and greatest star to join Serie A. Now, Gab, you mentioned the extraordinary concentration of world talent back then. Do you want to list some of the names that were in Serie A at the time? Diego at Napoli.
Zico Udinese.
Guy named Michel Platini. And Zibi Boniek
at Juventus. Falcao at Roma. Rummenigge, Passarella. Liam Brady at Inter. Souness and Francis at Sampdoria.
Socrates at Fiorentina.
Socrates. And how about this one? Michael Laudrup at Lazio.
Yeah. Bang. A Lazio side that went down that year.
That's incredible. Now, as you mentioned, at the time you can only have two foreign players per side. That was the rule. But not to worry, because the Italians were pretty good as well. They'd just gone and won the World Cup a couple of seasons before. So you had the likes of Zoff, Gentile, Cabrini, Scherea, Paolo Rossi, Conti, Tardelli, Graziani, all plying their trade up and down.
A young Vialli and Mancini.
Damn, yeah.
Yeah, and this was the year that Vialli went to Sampdoria as well.
Whereas Hellas Verona had who?
I mean, this is quite interesting. I mean, if we want to talk about the two foreigners that they had.
Right.
You have Hans-Peter Briegel, who'd been part of the West Germany side that had won the Euros in 1980 and played Italy in the final at the Bernabeu in 1982. And then you had Preben Elkjær.
Right. Crazy horse.
Yes.
In my youth, at that age, I was a little boy living in Tokyo. This was no internet, very little football on television. So you watch these things called VHS cassette tapes. And I have one of the story of the 1984-85 season. I think I must have watched it at least, by conservative estimate, 12 to 15,000 times. So I basically remember everything that happened that season. That was in the video. And what struck you about Briegel was that when he arrived, he had these enormous legs. Maybe he wore shin pads, but if he did, they were sort of tiny John Terry-sized shin pads. And he came in and he was, and in Germany, they viewed him as sort of just some kind of, you know, physical freak who ran around.
Well, you say that, Gab, because he was a decathlete who didn't actually start playing football until he was 17. He could run the 100 meters in 10.5 seconds.
Wow. He scored a lot of goals this season
he
as did. Well.
Yeah, he was their second top scorer.
Yeah. He scored more than Elkjær, in fact.
Mm.
But Elkjær scored better ones.
Right, including one of the most famous goals in Italian football, probably.
The Cinderella goal, because right. He loses his shoe.
Exactly. All right, well, we'll get onto that very shortly, I should think. So you had the two foreigners who I think had caught their eye at the European Championships that summer in France, and Verona brought them in. The rest of the team, is it fair to say, the likes of Nanu Galderisi and the keeper who I'd forgotten entirely about, Claudio Garella, who was famous for using his feet. What an outlandish concept.
He was, or Garellique, as they called him. Because,
like Diabolique.
Diabolique, yeah.
Diabolique, a famous cartoon cat burglar.
He was one of those guys who, stylistically, as you know, goalkeeping nerds will tell you, that like nothing he does is orthodox. He just kind of throw a bit of his body in front of the ball, and he get to it every time. We should point out that Verona had finished, was it fourth the previous year?
Yeah. Sixth the previous year. But then, so they came up from Serie B in 1981 and immediately finished fourth under Osvaldo Bagnoli. His first season in charge was the season they won the Serie B title.
And also, he got them up. You look at the teams that were in Serie B that year. There was Lazio and Milan, who'd been relegated as part of the Totonero scandal. Mm. And there were the two Genoa clubs, Genoa and Sampdoria. So, wow. I mean, that's quite a feat in itself.
That team had a lot of players who, with hindsight, I don't know how gifted they were, but Italian football thought that they were gifted. So, you know, you mentioned there Galderisi, who, you know, he's sort of a little small striker, Nanu. Who, you know, and known as Nanu, which means
midget,
yeah. It's not very PC for him, but small person. Even though he wasn't even that small, but he scored a lot of goals. And he would then go on to of course, play for Italy. Not very well, but he did play for Italy. They had this midfielder named Antonio Di Gennaro, who was a kind of regista that, again, I don't think would exist in the modern game, because he was the kind of guy who could really pass, but sort of moved at 2 miles an hour. And at the back then they played with two markers and a sweeper. They had Roberto Tricella, who's another guy who then he would go on, move to Juventus. You know, he's the kind of sort of slow central defender who could go and hit a long pass. And in the modern game, with the offside trap and whatever, it doesn't really work anymore. It didn't really work for Juventus. But another Italian international, as was, by the way, Pietro Fanna, who that was maybe the guy who, he came through the ranks at Juve, ended up at Verona. He wasn't considered too much, but he was a winger. He was sort of bald by the time he was 20.
Like James.
Yeah, no, even before, 13.
But he's another one of those guys who then people thought was going to be really good and then didn't quite make the
grade. Do you know who else they had before they got the Scudetto-winning side together?
Joe Jordan,
Lo Squalo. Yeah, had a season there. Not a desperate season. I think he scored two goals all campaign after
but essentially
exploits at Milan.
All of these players that Gab's just mentioned were kind of rejects who'd been on
cast-offs.
They'd been on the margins of these top sides, a little bit like Bagnoli himself, who came through at Milan, the side with Lidholm, Schiaffino. He won titles with them, but he never felt they were his own. Mm. And you know, when he starts managing, he essentially assembles a team full of players a bit like him.
People of the Totally Football Shows, you know what you could be listening to right here? You, your company, your product, out here in front of hundreds and thousands of listeners who are mostly men between the ages of 25 and 44. As well as the twice-weekly Totally Football Show, we've got a network of other football shows. There's Galazzo for the discerning cosmopolitan listener. There's the Totally Football League Show for the loyal, hardy listener. And there's the Totally Scottish Football Show for your listener who likes those big square sausages. And we've got even more podcasts on the way in 2019. Some of them not even based around football or indeed sport. To discuss advertising on one of the Totally Football Shows or across the Muddy Knees Media Network, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. We reach well over 1 million pairs of ears each week, and now you can too. Email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.
The season begins with, of all teams, Maradona's Napoli. And what does Diego Maradona do in this game? Nothing.
He gets breagled.
Yeah. And Maradona, for those who forget, this is the year that, of course, he arrived in the helicopter and everything. And also, they had this extremely athletic, I mean, couldn't play football, but he was very athletic center half named Fontolan. And normally, you figure if you're going to man mark Maradona, and everybody man marks, you're going to man mark him with a smaller guy. Mind your memory of this is the times that Fontolan would move away from the Napoli striker, who was either Pellegrini or Diaz back then, probably Ramon Diaz.
I think it was Ramon Diaz.
And the two would just go and just road grade Maradona. But Brigo.
What? What's the verb there?
Road grade.
Okay. Like I think I get the sense
flatten.
Of it.
Asfaltare.
Yeah, okay. Asfaltare, there
okay.
you go.
Very nice. A 3-1 win for Verona. Same scoreline they came up with in the second game at Ascoli. They then did Udinese. They had a 0-0 draw with Inter, who were among the favourites for the title that year. And then, Gab, I'm guessing that one of the highlights for you, maybe, of this campaign was the Week 5 clash when Juventus, who'd won 3 of the previous 4 Scudettos...
had beaten them in the Coppa Italia final as well, in
right.
one of the two that they played under Bagnoli. Because this is the thing, Bagnoli and his Verona players say, we were building towards this. We obviously were a massive outsiders. No one tipped us for the title. But we knew we were quite a decent side. We'd finished 4th, 6th. We'd been to 2 Coppa Italia finals where we'd lost to the 2 preeminent teams of that era, Roma and Juventus. And, yeah, could mix it. And this game, the Juventus one at the Bentegodi, is, yeah, I'd say one of the most memorable in the club's entire history, let alone that season.
Right. 2 goals. The second one is, the Cinderella goal. Tell us more.
So what, Elkjær picks it up essentially sort of just inside Juventus's half, Scarpa's down the sort of left-hand side.
Loses
his boot very early on in the actual move before, you know, sort of...
I think it's a challenge from Pioli, Stefano Pioli.
Mm, yeah, and manages to hold it off and finish.
With his stockinged foot.
Exactly, and kills the game. That was the second goal in a 2-0 win.
Oh, Stefano Tacconi. Wow, Gabriele.
The man who saved the moon.
I'm sorry?
Stefano Tacconi.
How did he save the moon?
He wrote a book and then was just made into a film.
Oh, really?
Ho parato la luna. I saved the moon.
What does that mean?
You need to ask him.
Okay.
He's one interesting dude.
He is, isn't it? I had a chance to meet him once, actually.
You didn't ask him about that? Was it
no,
at the film premiere?
Sadly not. Wow. Put into perspective how big that was. A Juve team who later that season, or at the end of that season, would become European champions amid the horrors of Heysel. Right.
And who, I think it was around that time that they also, or maybe shortly thereafter, they played Liverpool in the European Super Cup, which back then wasn't a curtain raiser, but they played it during the year.
Mm.
They had won the year before. Liverpool had won the European Cup, beating Roma on penalties, and Juve had won the Cup Winners' Cup. Juve excuses, oh, our focus was, of course, on the cup and winning the, you know. But it was a really big deal.
Right.
At that point. And I think while the big joke with Bagnoli, and in my video, he repeats it almost like every week, like, it's like, oh, yeah, well, we're counting the points now to
survival.
To survival, you know, ha, 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 the Salvezza, all the stuff. But really at that point, and he's trying to be clever about it. He's trying to keep them humble and grounded and whatever, but he knew it was all gravy. And he knew at that point that he looked around and, you know, Juve were having issues and
Roma had Svenja and Eriksson.
Roma, yeah. Well, and Falcao.
Falcao had gone.
But there were certainly issues. Inter couldn't find a shape, or they couldn't settle on a team. Milan were on their way back from Calcioscommesse.
So I suppose, I mean, the comparison...
Leicester, no?
Is Leicester. And what Claudio Ranieri said is, like, you need not just one big, two big, three big teams to have an off-season, if you like. But I still don't think that detracts in any way from what Verona achieved. Also because you look at the region, no one had won anything in the Veneto, even though the Veneto is what? Italy's largest region, one of the richest after Lombardy. And aside from that, you have Venezia had won the Coppa Italia in the 1940s with Valentino Mazzola and Ezio Loic. In the late 70s, you had Vicenza, who went on that incredible run and finished second with Paolo Rossi, who'd scored 24 goals. But no one had, and no one has since, done what Verona did in that region. So,
yeah. What were your other highlights from the season? A season in which they didn't lose a game until January.
So I remember some crazy game where Michel Platini had started the season slowly and he was getting criticized. People were starting to wonder, you know, has he lost it? And of course, he'd finish the season as top scorer.
And Ballon d'Or.
And win the Ballon d'Or.
Do you know he was second that year, by the way?
Elkia.
Yeah. Extraordinary.
But I mean, that was also a reflection of what Italian football was at the time. You know, everybody was focused on it. I know it might not have been on Channel 4 yet here in England, but in the rest of the world, it was kind of a big deal.
Tokyo.
Well, it wasn't on in Tokyo either, to be fair.
It was, actually.
Were you there for that Intercontinental Cup where Platini scores the greatest goal ever to be disallowed?
Not only was I there, I was at the training session the day before. I remember Platini scoring that goal. I remember Platini not signing any autographs and having sort of he had this big overcoat. And he cut.
How old were you at the time?
It was 12.
That's amazing.
People stopped and signed autographs, and Trapattoni invited us in because Trapattoni, of course, is from Cusano Milanino, which is where my family's from.
Short walk from.
Short walk from Abovisa. Yeah, and the incredible thing about Platini, and you can still see this on YouTube, is he scores that amazing goal. It gets disallowed for dangerous play. And afterwards, he goes and he just lies down on the pitch with his elbow, just like with his grin on his face, like sort of marveling at the absurdity of it all. But yeah, going back, you asked me one of the highlights where Platini was getting a lot of criticism. So he decided that he wasn't going to say anything. He didn't say anything pregame. He played in some game where I think he scored two goals and he delivered this sort of stupid back heel assist and they won 4-0 or 4-1 and he walked off the pitch and he said he wouldn't say anything other than the fact that, you know, something like, you know, that's for the critics, up to you now. Something like that, you know. And this is sort of like peak Platini, peak sort of, some would say, arrogance.
Was that the Galeazzi?
Michel. Who was the burly interviewer, former Olympic rower who'd become an interviewer for Rai, the state television. Was it Juve Atalanta 5-1? Would that have been it?
Yes, I think that might have been it. With Benevelli, I think, filling in goal.
Anyway, our friends at Verona haven't lost a single game. But as the second half of the season gets underway in January, Inter have finally pulled level with them, which I think, you know, whatever Bagnoli thinks about it, whatever his players think about what might be happening, I think it was taken by the press as the dream is over. Here the fairy tale ends. But instead of letting that get to them, Verona then produced one of their most extraordinary performances. They had a trip to Zico's Udinese where they stormed it.
They were 3-0 up and then Udinese came back and it was 3-3. And just when you thought, oh, Verona are going to panic here, within 2 minutes they were 5-3 up again and just completely saw them off. And this is the extraordinary thing about this season that Verona had, is that they led the league from start to finish. Even though you said that Inter basically drew level on points with them and looked like they were going to challenge, a few weeks later it was Gigi Radice and Aldo Serena's Torino who all of a sudden looked like they were going to be the ones to push through. And they held them off as well and just completely threw it out with, what, a couple of games to spare. So.
Right, 12th of May, penultimate round of the season there in Bergamo, taking on Atalanta, needing a point. Atalanta already mathematically safe, nothing to play for really. The stadium, Atleti Azzurri d'Italia, is full of Butei. Is that pronounced right? The
Bouteille.
If you go to the Bentegodi, there is a monument to the Bouteille, the Verona Ultras.
There we are. It's the penultimate day of the season, and that roar you can hear is Atalanta 1-0 up at home to Verona. Perico, who hadn't scored in 10 years.
Suddenly became pericoloso.
Yeah, nice. But, of course, 5 minutes into the second half, who should collect a loose ball in the box but Pribanelkia? And Hellas, our champions.
Il Verona campione d'Italia 1984-85.
Maglioli, sei campione d'Italia e non mi dire che non te lo meriti, eh?
Ma ce lo meritiamo tutti.
Quando pensi di aver vinto questo scudetto?
Ma ci sono stati tanti momenti, però penso che il momento più ci siamo resi conto di averlo vinto è stato Torino con la Juventus.
The aforementioned Galeazzi there interviewing Osvaldo Bagnoli. That was the only time he smiled all season, according to one of his players afterwards.
What I like about Bagnoli, another anecdote that the players tell, was that when it came to match day, usually hearing these sort of stories about sort of fairy tale title wins, that the manager sort of had these great team talks and come up with these imaginative tactical schemes, and yet on match day he apparently would just sit in the corner of the dressing room reading La Gazzetta dello Sport. And said, come on, we did all the work in the week, you know what to do.
It's Atalanta.
It's Atalanta. And they would go out and just execute, you know.
The thing about Atalanta is, I mean, you mentioned that they were safe. They've been newly promoted. Two of the teams with the most important sort of historically ultras groups. I think that season, there were a couple of themes running throughout. One, and this was one of the times that Bagnoli really, really lost his cool and really started isolating Verona was, there were a couple games where Garella made a bunch of saves. I think it was in the Napoli game, actually. And it was presented as if, like, Garella saves Verona, blah, blah, blah. Oh, Garella's taking Verona. And sort of the novelty of having this little team, people started getting annoyed, right? The big club. They were very good at developing this siege mentality. And he famously, with a radio, is a legendary Italian radio presenter named Enrico Ameri. He absolutely lost it. And he just kind of came out and said, look, you know, we may not be historically a big club, but we're not in first place just because of Garella. He's one of many. In fact, some of the saves that you laud to high heaven, a goalkeeper has to be asleep to go and let the goal in. Mm-hmm. But what it created was a sense among a lot of the smaller clubs, like Atalanta and their fans, a certain admiration where they almost got behind Verona that season.
The provincial team that could.
Yeah.
But let's get on to the other thing, because they are the only provincial side in the history of Italian football since a unified national top division was instituted in 1929. The only time that a team that's not from one of the kind of regional capitals, Turin, Rome, Milan, or Genoa, or Florence, actually won the title. By coincidence, this was the only season that referees for Serie A matches were randomly assigned their matches. This had been instituted, I think, Gabrielli, after the betting scandal of Calcio Scommessi, as a way of trying to clean up the image of the Italian game. And at the end of that season, with this experiment in place, the top four was Verona, Torino, Inter, Samp, which is kind of unusual.
Yeah, amazing how that works.
I mean, there's an interesting story from the second round of the European Cup, when obviously Verona going in as Italian champions, they were drawn against Juventus in that game, who were the champions of Europe. And I think they lost, was it at the Comunale? And one of the Verona players broke a window in the dressing room, and the police came in, and Bagnoli said, if you're looking for thieves, they're in the other dressing room.
Damn.
That's a recurring theme in Italian football, but...
Tell you what, they've still got to go to the Bentegodi and get something.
but I think there really was sort of a sense, because remember too, what we mentioned before about, you know, the spending and the foreigners that came in. I remember one argument that was made by Boniperti, the Juve president, saying, but because we have this limit on foreigners, yeah, we may be richer, but it's not really fair because we can only buy two good foreigners, and there's more than two good foreigners out there. And so the little teams go and buy the other good foreigners, and that's not fair. because otherwise we would buy them.
How did you feel about that game?
Kind of like, all right, you know, just why don't you just come out and say it then, right. You know? And in fact, was it the year after that that they, you know, added a third foreigner?
Right.
And it, we had the three foreigner rule, and then 10 years later, Bosman came.
And this is the great thing that, as Bonnie Petty was making this argument, this was, what, the beginning of a very bleak run for Juve now. Mm. They went 9 years, was it 9 years without a title?
They won the title the year after.
Ah, okay.
But that was sort of like the last hurrah before the Lippi era. Mm. And the year after, when they won the title, coincides with, I think, one of the most incredible collapses in the history of Italian football, which was Lecce Roma.
Ah, Sven.
Ai confini della realtà. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's really. Yeah.
Well, that's a story.
When they entered the time, that's a story for another time.
That's a story
but
for a special Sven Golazzo, which is surely only weeks away. Much loved figure there. And one who's furnished us with all sorts of stories. But anyway, that was Hellas Verona and their greatest season ever, and one of Italian football's finest campaigns. After this, let's just catch up on what's happened to them since. Giallo Blue Army is arriving, title of that little number. And it's not been going particularly well since they won the Italian title. Within 5 years, they'd gone down. Not long after that, they went bankrupt in 1991. Since then, they've gone as far down as C1, the third division, almost went down into the fourth. They've come up sometimes, 2002. You remember the team they had in 2002 with Mutu, Camoranesi, Gelardino, Massimo Oddo. Manager was Alberto Malassani. Vintage times.
Who went under the Cordova when they beat Chievo in the derby. That's fantastic. Yeah. Check that on YouTube. It's amazing.
Still one of the greatest men in the history.
Malassani.
Of the universe.
Okay, yes. Well, obviously we've got Malassani Golazzo coming up as well. Focusing on the photocopier years, I presume.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. But a lot of yo-yoing up and down between Serie A and Serie B. 15-16 season, they didn't win a single match until February.
Hey, we should
wait.
Yeah,
sorry, Gab.
Luca Toni
Capocannonieri.
Yeah. Well, we did all that in the Luca Toni special.
We should also mention.
Don't gloss over it.
Well, I think one of the reasons is that even though they did have bursts of success, the big story in Verona since the turn of the millennium has been the fabulous Pandoro making.
The big story in Verona, as ever, is Romeo and Juliet, right. Is the lake, is right. The...
And if you like, Capulets arena. To Verona's Montagues have been Chievo, who've kind of won the hearts of fans and analysts everywhere.
Chievo, who last week had their appeal for that three-point penalty. They wanted it obviously overturned.
Right.
No, it still stands. So.
They're still bottom of the pile.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows, maybe next season they'll be having derbies again with Verona, because Verona are currently down in Serie B, but they're hoping that they're going to be back up in the top flight next time. They're currently fifth.
Yeah. 7 points off Dean Holdsworth's Palermo.
Yeah. Extraordinary. Who are currently still topping the table, although they did they went down last weekend, didn't they, Palermo? They were defeated. Serie B got back into action. Verona these days, who are managed by Fabio Grosso, and count among their ranks Scotland's very own Liam Henderson, who's been having a fascinating career, Liam Henderson.
Well, yeah, I mean, Grosso took him with him from Bari to Hellas Verona. He's been doing pretty well there, both playing in sort of defence midfield. But yeah, Verona lost the, it's a derby, isn't it, with Padova last week. They lost,
oh, did they?
They lost 3-0.
Are they kind of more financially secure these days, Gab, do you know?
Well, they had this guy,
Maurizio Setti,
who, when they were up and with Mandolini as their manager, and it all looked like, you know, they were there. They had those shirts that were sponsored by
his clothing line, is it?
But it was like, it wasn't Abercrombie. It was like an Abercrombie & Fitch
Frankie Garage,
knockoff,
something like that.
No. It was Franklin and Marshall.
Okay.
Ah, yeah, you're right.
It's a university in the U.S., and then suddenly people started knocking off their logos and putting it on apparel, and it became insanely popular with the herd mentality that exists among certain European countries. But yeah, this guy said there's all sorts of dispute between him and the guy who's his financial backer, and it's just another ugly situation, needless situation, with combination of bad people owning football clubs in Italy and a lack of proper oversight coupled with a diabolically slow legal system.
So there they are, fifth in Serie B. And it would be fascinating to see them come back up, especially if they were to do it in style.
And trade places with Chievo.
Possibly, yeah, so.
They're one of those teams that belong in Serie A. You know, people say, like, oh, well, Leeds should be in the Premier League. Yeah, Verona should be in Serie A. Arguably the only team from Veneto who should be.
Right, and Frosinone shouldn't. We'll touch on that a little bit later. We'll touch on that a little bit later. And Gab, I know you have to leave us now, but James, you and I are about to go sailing into the modern-day situation in the top flight as we touch on the return of Serie A this weekend and what awaits us in the coming days with a particularly exciting round of matches. Campionato di calcio
italiano. You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show.
Serie A came back this weekend, James Horncastle.
Mm-hmm.
And a very interesting set of results that left things ever so tight in the race for fourth place. Not so much above them, where you've got Juve 9 points clear of second place, Napoli, who themselves are 7 points clear of Inter. But below them, five teams, each 1 point apart, Milan, Roma, Lazio, Atalanta and Sampdoria, who were involved in, would you say, the game of the weekend at the Franchi?
It had everything, James, in that Fiorentina were on top and went down to 10 men. And yet they somehow contrived to get a point in a game when their new signing, debutant Luis Muriel, scored two original Ronaldo-esque goals, which is, of course, someone who he actually looks like.
What do you think?
Well, if you put their kind of Panini stickers at an early early time in their careers together, there is a resemblance there. Certainly, he likes to think there is.
Right.
And to be honest, his goals, particularly his second,
a Ronaldo-esque run, definitely,
yes.
Phenomenal run for the second. So you had goal del ex, two of those. You had goal from Quagliarella, a brilliant. Two guys tight on him, slinging him to the ground, but he still gets the shot off and scores for how many matches in a row is that now?
10 straight, James. He's just one away from Gabriel Batistuta's all-time record, which was established in 94-95. I think they play Udinese, his former team, at the weekend. So we'll have to see if big Fabio can actually match the record then.
Well, Samp still very much then in the picture for that final Champions League place. This weekend, some really important games. Lazio, who are currently in sixth place, but only 2 points off the top four, will be hosting Juventus.
Yes, I don't think they have much of a chance in that.
Really?
Well, Lazio are on a real slump at the moment. Only two wins in their last nine. Mm. And while Sergej Milinkovic-Savic showed signs of life at the end of the calendar year, they need more, really. I think they're real at risk because if you look at the form that Roma and Atalanta are in, and they play this weekend in Bergamo, I think that for me is the biggest game of matchday 21.
Well, there's an interesting argument to be made then because the team that beat Lazio last weekend, Napoli, and beat them despite being without four absolute cast iron starters in Alan, Hamzic, Insigne, and Koulibaly. Were, of course, Carlo Ancelotti's Napoli, and a fine win for them. They are going to be travelling to Milan, where Milan are themselves coming off a 2-0 win away at Genoa Monday afternoon. Why were they playing on Monday afternoon?
Okay, for two reasons. I mean, you look at the history between these two clubs. You were there, James, when
Genoa Spagnolo
ultra was killed. So it's always been a tense affair, this one. But also, it was just classic politicking, point scoring by the Interior Minister Matteo Salvini, a reaction to the violence that happened but before the Inter-Napoli game, before Christmas. So that's why you ended up having this game Monday, 3 o'clock, in a city, as General Manager Cesare Prandelli said, has all kinds of problems at the moment in terms of congestion because of the Morandi Bridge disaster. You know, people at work, so they couldn't come and see the game. And Genoa Ultra is actually striking anyway because of this decision. So, yeah, Prandelli, I think, quite rightly made the case that his side felt penalised by it. But huge result for Milan.
So what those people missed who didn't make it to the game was a big victory and a fantastic performance by a player everyone's getting very excited about. So the background to this is the fact that Milan, who are losing Higuain, at least on loan, to Chelsea, are replacing him with the guy who's lit up the first half of Genoa's season. So Higuain wasn't playing because he's on his way to Chelsea, and Genoa didn't field the player who they're now sending to Milan, Piontek.
Because he was suspended.
Because he was suspended anyway. Okay, yeah. Perfect. So without those two, star of the show was the new arrival from Brazil, Paqueta.
Highlight reel sort of stuff where he hit the post with a wonderful, yeah, sumptuous volley. But I think the one piece of skill that everyone got really excited about was his bicicleta, where he...
Which is not a bicycle kick.
No, he was taking on Bessa.
I want to call it a rainbow flick.
Exactly. That's, right, I think, what most people would call it in English. But yeah, put the ball between his heels and then flicked it over Bessa. Ran past him, then gave the ball away back to Bessa, and right, Bessa almost scored.
That's all by the by. Milan won anyway, 2-0, and that sets up a really interesting clash with Napoli this weekend. Sorry.
Well, James, do you know what Milan's record this season without Higuain is?
Is it not good?
They've played five. They're unbeaten in, ooh, five. They've won three. They've drawn two. They're obviously better off without him. And yeah, Piontek is expected to make his debut against Napoli, which is also what Pato did. I think it's also Higuain. I think he made his, really, Milan debut against Napoli as well. So
it's a huge game, that. And there's a fascinating Polish duel in prospect. Yeah. Because on one hand, Piontek, who's had that incredible start to the season at Genoa, against Napoli's Polish striker,
Eric
Milic.
Yeah.
Who himself found the net in fine fashion.
Yeah, and finds the net in different ways. He's been scoring free kicks for them recently, which I must admit, I didn't think it was a skill he had in his locker, but he's coming up really big with these set pieces. And yeah, these two guys, very much the future of that Polish national team once Robert Lewandowski winds down. So it should be a really interesting game, although Napoli, as you mentioned, James, super impressive. I think just to underline the job that Ancelotti is doing, they've only had more points at this stage of the season on two occasions. One was last year under Maurizio Sarri, and the other time was when Napoli defended their first title in 87-88 with Maradona in the team. So he keeps defying expectation, Carlo.
All right. It was a brilliant match earlier on in the season between these two teams. The other game that you're saying is going to out-spectacle even that is Atalanta-Roma. And you're probably right. Atalanta coming into this incredible form, fresh from a 5-0 win at Frosinone with four goals scored by one player.
Yeah, Duvan Zapata, who is the hottest striker in the league so far. Since the start of December, James, only two teams have scored more goals than Duvan Zapata.
On his own?
On his own.
Wow.
He scored 14 in 10. And he scored the perfect poker, if you like, against Frosinone, two headers, and then scored goals with his left and his right foot as well. So this game is between the two sides who are vying for fourth place.
Only 2 points between them.
Yeah, and Roma, who been linked with a Atalanta centre-back, Gianluca Mancini, who scored in that 5-0 win, not from a set piece either. Just goes to show that, you know, these Atalanta centre-backs get forward even in open play and score goals. He scored more goals as a defender than any other defender in Europe's top five leagues this season, Gianluca Mancini. But he is one of the very promising young Italian players. You look at that Roma midfield, you look at Zaniolo's performance against Torino. He is justifiably getting a lot of people excited because it wasn't only his goal, his all-round play. Roma fans are beginning to, you know, really enjoy.
Roma with a win over Torino, Atalanta with a victory over Frosinone. And what are they doing in Serie A, Frosinone?
The brilliant thing about that is this is the Aurelio De Laurentiis interview that
Rory Smith.
President gave to Rory Smith. Yeah. And it was in December.
Okay,
so before Liverpool played Napoli at Anfield, and it came out just after this 5-0 defeat that Frosinone had. I think it's entirely fair. And
right.
De Laurentiis has been banging this drum for some time that Serie A needs to go back to being an 18-team league. Because we keep seeing the likes of Benevento, Frosinone just set records for low point scoring.
A couple of bits of transfer news. Is Alan going to go to Paris Saint-Germain for 100 million from Napoli?
Well, they haven't received an offer yet, but certainly PSG have spoken to Alan's people. And I think Napoli are beginning to prepare for his departure. Maybe not in January, but in the summer, because they're in talks with Pablo Fornals, the Villarreal midfielder. And obviously, I think they're ahead of everyone when it comes to trying to lure Nicolò Barella away from Cagliari as well. So I think, yeah, Alan... This might be his final season in Naples.
Okay, and then the one move that everyone's been expecting, Kevin Prince-Boateng turning up at Barcelona from Sassuolo.
Ah, you can mock, James. You can mock. But I think this is also reflective
of the fact that... work really well. He's been doing great. For a bit. It just came completely out of the blue, I think, for everybody, no?
Yeah, I mean, they've been in talks for, I think, a month now. But, I mean, it's been kept pretty hush-hush.
Right.
Also, I mean, Sassuolo, who, I have to remember, I mean, this is quite an incredible thing for them. You know, this is a team that has only been in Serie A for 3 or 4 years, does not have a huge profile, and Barcelona is coming to sign one of their players. You also look at the strategy that has helped Sassuolo get to where they are now. It's been sort of forging links with Juventus and Roma to sort of help develop their players. I think they're now going to this next step, which is to forge links with international clubs of Barcelona's profile. You look at the player that they've got at the back, Marlon, who came from Barca. I think they're going to try and bring other young Barcelona players to, with a view to developing them. I think it's testament of how kind of smart Sassuolo are, really. It's just a shame that Balotelli is not going to be replacing Boateng, because that would have been magic.
Absolutely. Okay, super. Well, look forward to further developments. Galazzo will return next Wednesday with Gabriele Marcotti and James Horncastle. And hey, listener, I hope you as well. Have yourselves a great week in the meantime. And for now, from all of us here, it's arrivederci.
You've been listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Check out our other football shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audioboom, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.